and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday, Wednesday edition. Is that the best way to say that, Tim?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately, due to some issues with recording, we had to push the show off for a day, so we appreciate everybody's patience and understanding on that. But we're back, and we've got a full show for you, including the best of the best, dumb crime, stupid criminals, coming up in just a bit. Oh, and we've got some doozies, Tim. We've got some doozies. Let's get started. Yeah, some doozies. Okay. As a matter of fact, you know, how do you deal with a dead person in your driveway that you have no clue who they are, but yet there's videotape of you having drinks with that person, just a couple hours ago?
That's a good question.
Yeah. Oh, that's just the stupidity. That's a new word I've just created. Coin it, Tim. Trademark it and make a website, stupidity.
Consider it done. Yeah.
Ooh, that might be the cologne I create by Fabergé. What do you think? Stupidity.
Is Fabergé still around other than eggs?
I don't know. I thought they do brutes.
Oh, maybe brutes.
Yeah, see?
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know what you're all getting right for Christmas.
Probably a divorce if I start wearing brute. Let's get to it. This afternoon we're being joined by Greg Olson. He's a number one New York Times bestseller and Amazon chart bestselling author who has written more than 30 books, including Lying Next to Me and The Last Thing She Ever Did, plus two novels in the Nicole Foster series, The Sound of Rain and The Weight of Silence. He's appeared on multiple television and radio shows and programs. He's here today to talk with us about his book, If You Tell, A True Story of Murder, Family Secrets, and the Unbreakable Bond of Sisterhood. Greg Olson, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
All right. Let's dive right in. I mean, this is a dark, very strange story.
It's got to be the darkest story really ever told, I think. It rivals something like the Sylvia Likens case in Indiana, which was a young girl was tortured to death. It's just unbelievable, but it's all true.
What's hard to believe is, you know, this kind of story you expect to hear maybe from like the 30s or the 40s. And I don't know why I even put it in that time era, but to me that just seems like this is like a throwback kind of mentality and the way that we act and treat ourselves and children. But this took place, what, in 2003? Is that right?
Yeah, that's when it ended, but it started back in the early 90s.
All right, well,
it spans a decade.
Yeah, it spans a decade. You were starting to say, let's dive in. Maybe introduce us to the players in this. How do you say it? Is it Notek? Is that how you say the last name?
Yeah, that's right. Shelley Notek is the main player, although her husband, Dave, is a willing participant in her crimes. But her crimes focused first on her three daughters. So she has these three girls by three different husbands, and she is just, you know, a sadist is what she is. She just always is thinking of new ways to hurt them, to scare them, to make them feel like they're worthless. So she's doing this. And then as the time goes on, she starts inviting other people into the household and being kindly at first and then systematically breaking them down until three people end up dead.
Well, let's go into her past, Shelley Notek. Was this always a part of her? Was there this thread of evil that had always been present, or was this something that happened, I don't know, maybe after postpartum depression kicked in after her first child?
No. When you look back at Shelley's life, I mean, I always do. I always think like what makes people what they are. And, you know, Shelley does have a dark background of her own. Her mother was a drug addict and alcoholic, and she ended up murdered when Shelley was just a little girl. Shelley kind of, we don't know really what went on with the mom, but we know that when Shelley came to live with her father and her stepmother, she started exhibiting very strange behavior. I mean, she, you know, was a pathological liar. She put broken glass in her siblings' shoes. She set a couple of fires in the house. I mean, she did things that no normal kid would do, right?
So these signs ended up kind of psychosis, they started very early on for her then.
Absolutely. And here's the key to the whole thing, I think, is that she was befriended by her Grandma Anna, and Grandma Anna took her under her wing. And Grandma Anna was a sadistic person, no doubt. She had a husband that she made sleep outside in their well house or on the porch. She had a couple of workers. She had run a nursing home for years, and she had two workers, two women, that she would, you know, chop their hair off. She would shove their heads in the toilet if they misbehaved. She, you know, beat them and did all sorts of things right in front of Shelley. So there's a lot of that, too. It's like, we, you know, you often think, like, well, what kind of person would do the things Shelley would do later in life? Well, she's going to be the kind of person that's mimicking things that she had seen growing up.
Was this grandmother, was she employing people of special needs? I just have a hard time believing she could just chop off people's hair, dunk their heads in toilets, and they'd be back again for the next day of work.
Yeah, they were special needs women that she'd gotten from Western State Hospital here in the Seattle area. So she brought them in, you know, as workers. And they were just, they were easy prey. And that's kind of, I think, another thing that comes into Shelley's story is that as a predator, she learned from her grandmother, you pick on people that you can get away with. And Shelley would do that later in life, for sure.
That's unbelievably terrifying and heartbreakingly sad all at the same time to think that this is going on and that it was just okay. And, you know, as a human, Greg, you think you watch some kind of inhumanity like this, like your grandmother doing these things. You think your first inclination would be empathy and, oh my God, what's wrong with this woman? But instead she starts to emulate and act like that. That means there's a few pistons not firing properly as well.
But here's the thing. When, and this is typical of a lot of abuse cases, when it's in a family, not everyone's picked on, right? And the ones that aren't being picked on are glad it's not them. So they look the other way a little bit, or they, you know, they don't stop the abuse. They can't, because if they do, then they're going to be the target. So that plays into this situation too with Shelley, in that, you know, when she picked on her children, and most likely she picked mostly on the oldest daughter, made her do unbelievable things, and we can get into that if you want to. But then the middle daughter would be grateful that it wasn't her being picked on. So there's some of that going on, and I think Shelley was a sadist, but she was also, as a child, a survivor. She knew that if you join in with the Third Reich or whatever, you're going to be saved, you know, in her mind.
That's sad, but now I guess giving me that perspective, it does give you a little bit more insight on it. You either, you know, either join them or you're succumbed and overtaken by them.
That's right.
Well, all right, so she would try to torture her own sisters and family. Three failed relationships, or at least two failed relationships, it sounds like, with these men.
Both of those men, they were, you know, they saw what Shelley was really all about. In the beginning, I mean, she was a beautiful woman. She had red hair, you know, beautiful blue eyes, and a fantastic figure. She was a stunning woman. But once you got to know her and got to see what kind of things she was up to, you know, you got out of there. And that's why those first two husbands left.
I understand you're in a relationship with somebody and they start acting bizarre and perhaps violent or whatever, but do you just abandon your children? You abandon that life and move on as though that's unimportant? That, I'm not trying to make the father's a villain in this story as well, but I mean, in a sense, there's so many failings that happened for these three girls.
That's right. But the thing about the fathers, I know for a fact at least one of them wrote to their daughter and sent presents and things, but Shelley would just get them and destroy them, not give them to the child. So I don't know, you know, it's like if you called on the phone to try to talk to your daughter, Shelley would say, well, they're not there. They're not here. No one's home. When in fact, of course, they were home. So she really built a wall. And one of the ways she did that also was living out in a rural community. Like, you couldn't just do a drive-by to stop by. You had to make a big effort to get out there to see the kids. And if you didn't, you know, have an appointment, or even if you did, it was likely that when Shelley, you know, when you knocked on that door, Shelley wasn't going to answer. They were there. She just, you know, led you on like you could see the daughter. So I don't blame them. I know that, you know, I'm a dad, you're a dad, I guess, and I would do anything I could to be close to my family. And I think they tried. But when you're dealing with someone like Shelley, who's always right and always thinking of a way to, you know, punish somebody, having you not being able to see your child is just another way for her to get even.
Yeah, I guess that would be just another tool of her trade in the way she treats people. All right, so she has these children. Is she showing signs of abuse to these children, to the fathers? I mean, are they aware that it's taking place, or were they leaving simply because of the bizarre way she treated them?
Yeah, they left because of the way she handled herself as a human being and the lies that she told, and the, you know, she was always trying to make trouble with everybody's family so that they, you know, the husbands would be dependent on her. So she did, once they got wind of that, there was going to be no more of Shelley for sure in their lives because you couldn't trust her. And I don't think that the abuse at all to the children was visible to anybody except for Dave, who was a participant in some of the abuse, and that Dave was the last husband.
So she suddenly finds somebody like her, somebody that's malleable, sees what's going on, and instead of causing trouble, just becomes part of the problem.
That's right. And here's the thing, Dave. He was a nice guy. There isn't anybody that would say he wasn't growing up and as a young man and all that. But he got with her, and she broke him. She made him her soldier in this abuse. It wasn't like that was his nature at all. I mean, he was the opposite of Shelley, but she was so powerful in the way she manipulated him that he ended up going along and doing stuff that I know he wishes he hadn't done.
Oh, good God. I mean, all right. So
I was going to tell you, like, one of the things that she did with Dave was she fabricated that she had cancer early in their marriage. And she went as far as pretending she was getting medical appointments. She shaved her eyebrows off at one point. She pulled out her hair and powdered her face with a white makeup. I mean, she did whatever she could to reel him in on this sympathy thing. And he kept thinking, you know, she's crazy, but she's got cancer and she's the mother of my child. And I can't, you know, not be there for these kids. So he stayed in the beginning on the sympathy factor of her faked cancer, which, by the way, her cancer went on for 10 years. She used that cancer card, which she never had.
Well, how do you fake cancer, Greg? I mean, obviously you've got to go in for chemo and medical treatment. How do you fake cancer and keep people on the line about that?
She even went so far, Dave, as to have her husband, Dave, go to her appointments, and she would not allow him to come inside. She would go in and he'd have to wait while she was getting her chemo for a couple of hours, and then she would pop out. And we don't know really what she was doing at the time because she didn't have cancer, but her stepmother thinks, you know, Shelley just probably went out the back door, went shopping, and then came back in, you know, and then saw Dave in the car. I mean, that's what she thinks. But if you keep pounding that drumbeat over and over of, you know, oh, I'm sick today, the chemo's made me sick, you know, look at my hair is coming out in clumps, which she cut with scissors. You know, she was good at trying to show proof about what was happening to her when it was all a big lie.
And that he believed it.
He believed it because you think it's so stupid, right? that he would fall for that. And he told me, he said, you know what? When I interviewed him for the book, he said, I'm just a weak guy. I guess I'm weak. I just went along with a lot of stuff because I didn't want my daughters to be, by then he considered all three his daughters, to be alone in life. And whatever Shelley did or whatever she told him to do, because she was relentless, Dave. She would scream at him like you wouldn't hear. I mean, you could hear her if there was anyone nearby, but there wasn't because they lived out in the country. She would make him, you know, he worked out of the area. And when he came home, she would have a fight with him, make him, he never slept in the bed with her. He always had to sleep on the floor next to the bed or in the living room on the floor. He couldn't even sleep on the couch because she wouldn't allow that. And he went on with that. He just took it all and never really pushed back.
Well, and, you know, I do understand, having been part of one toxic marriage myself, how long you're willing to stay in something because of the children. And wanting to be there for the children and try to be that buffer. So I do, you know, I understand that to a degree. I mean, obviously, I found a line that he did not, but that is very strange to, you know, to see just how far somebody could be broken, especially somebody that didn't have a similar background or wasn't already appearingly fractured from the get-go.
Right.
There's one aspect of being complicit and staying in a bad relationship for the sake of being around your children. There's another when it just starts, you know, you start buying into the psychosis of what goes on. Did he ever figure out she didn't have cancer, or did she play that card the whole time?
Yeah, she just was a master of manipulation for sure. And she played the card over and over and over. I mean, it's very hard for us not being in that life to know what it really is like and really how bad it was. I tried to put it all in the book, and there's a lot in there. And I think part of what made this story happen for such a long period of time was the cumulative nature of her, the abuse. It was like, it was slow. And then it would build and build and build and build. And, you know, so you're like, you know, you're in it. And it's not so bad. I can put up with this. I can put up with that. But then by the time you get to the really heavy stuff, you're weak. And she's broken you down and you just take it.
When she started with her abuse on her children, and this is a tough question because I know there are going to be parents like myself cringing through this without getting too graphically involved in that. How old were the children when she began her kind of reign of terror on them?
Well, she did her first child, Nikki. One of her earliest memories, her first memory is of her mother trying to suffocate her with a pillow. And this is when she was probably three, probably. You know, mom was there. I woke up. She had this pillow over my face, and she pulled back and had a smile on her face. So I knew, she said, like, I was scared of her. I thought that, you know, why was she doing this to me? And that, you know, Nikki then became the target of more and more kind of abuse, including things like, you know, you can't use the bathroom unless I say so. In fact, I have to sit with you while you go. You can't, you know, you're going to wear the same clothes every day for a month because I'm mad at you. I mean, weird little things like that. Then they got to, you know, progressively violent and hurtful and abusive relationship beyond a game, a mind game.
She would make them wear the same clothes. She would...
She wouldn't let them have a bath. They couldn't even, they weren't even allowed, even when they were teenagers, they weren't allowed to shower unless she gave them permission and that she'd stand there while they did it. I mean, she did all sorts of weird stuff that we just, you know, that you think like, why would she even do that? What's the point of all that? But that's the kind of stuff that she did. If you worked hard on your homework, Shelley would find a way to get it from you and hide it from you and make you, you know, believe that you lost it. Or if you, it was time to go to school and you could only find one shoe that, and you couldn't find its mate, it was because Shelley had hidden it and, you know, would make you look all over the house. And then finally she'd produce it and say, oh, I just found it. You know, she did stuff like that all the time, like every day. That kind of stuff was going on.
Jeez. Did she, in doing this kind of activity, I mean, has she ever shown any remorse or felt any guilt for the things that she put the people that were supposed to, you know, supposed to be able to trust her and rely on her? Has she shown any kind of remorse at all?
No, none. In fact, I saw a letter that she wrote to her youngest daughter after she was incarcerated, and she said, you know, Tori, and that's the youngest daughter, she said, Tori, I only made you go in that kennel one time, you know, and you got to choose your punishment. So these are, you know, and this was a time when, you know, Tori didn't clean the kennel properly because they had a lot of dogs, and Shelley shoved her in there and locked it and got the hose out and sprayed her with the cold water. Well, you know, while she's trying to hose out the kennel. So, you know, Shelley, you know, like, you know, I loved you. You're listening to lies. None of that stuff happened like that. Or, you know, if I made you, pick up the yard with an axe handle in your pants, which is one of the things she did to Tori. It was only because you'd been bad. And you know that. That kind of never sorry. Always trying to still, you know, make those girls believe that the stuff that she did to them was normal.
Tim, I only stuck you in my trunk that one time at college and beat you with a rubber hose. I mean, you're really going to hold that against me? Holy cow.
Yes.
Yeah, it's really, it actually is that way. I mean, let's talk about the trunk, because that's when Shelley befriended her hairdresser, Kathy. She had Kathy come live in the house with them when just as Tori was being born to be a nanny. And, you know, Shelley worked very hard to ostracize Kathy from her family so that Kathy had no one in her circle but Shelley. And then she began to do things like have Kathy, you know, Kathy had like a nice bedroom in the beginning. And every other day, Shelley would take something away from the bedroom, like the nightstand, the lamp, the bed frame. And soon all Kathy had in her room was a mattress on the floor, okay? And then at some point, she says, you know what? You're going to have to sleep downstairs now. So she puts her in the boiler room, which is like a 5x7 space with a big boiler in it, and gives her a blanket and a pillow. And Kathy does that. But you alluded to the trunk. That's the weirdest part of the story to me. I mean, there's so much. But, you know, whenever they would go out, Kathy would ride in the trunk. If they had to do laundry, Kathy would be in the trunk the whole time. Well, the kids did the laundry, you know, and the kids, you know, accepted it. They just, that was Kathy, and that was what mom had done. So, you know, they would check on Kathy now and then while they were doing the laundry. Or if they went camping, Kathy could come along, but she was made to sleep under the truck or in the trunk. She wasn't allowed to be with the rest of the family. And Kathy, by then, she just accepted that too. Like, after you're beat up so bad mentally and maybe even drugged by your benefactor, which is Shelley, then maybe you end up doing things that you don't even know you're doing, because I can't imagine riding in a trunk. Can you?
No, or the acceptance of, well, that's Kathy.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's what God, they,
yeah, that's, I, my family, and maybe it's just because of my upbringing, we were the kind of family, if somebody came over we didn't like, my dad would have us lay on the floor and be quiet until they drove out of the driveway. Which, I, you know, on, as we're talking about strange things people do, could make us sound psychotic as well. But it was like, you learn to avoid people you don't want to be around. And when they're putting you through weird experiences, it's very hard. I'm not, and I, please understand, folks, I'm not trying to victimize the victims in this. It's just so hard to process in your head. How can this go on? How can people be complicit in their own abuse? But it happens, because it's, as you said, it seems like a slow, eventual breakdown. But then there must have been some other kind of payout for this to keep people in her circle. What was the pull? The guy, all right, I can understand. You said she was pretty, she was attractive, she was alluring. Guys are idiots, right? So we're going to get drawn.
No argument there.
Right, we're going to get drawn in by that. But other people, you know, your hairdresser being stuck and having to travel in the trunk. I just, what was the draw to keep her there?
Yeah, because she had nobody. See, by the time, you know, like you mentioned, laying on the floor to get rid of, you know, a visitor, you know, in Shelly's case, she would duct tape Kathy and put her in the closet if somebody came over, and Kathy would have to be in the closet for like 3 or 4 hours, just quietly. She just accepted it. So that's something very hard to understand. Like, I know you're getting at that. It's like, you know, why doesn't she run? In fact, one time Kathy did run away. She made it all the way to the next town's mall, and Shelly somehow found her and ended up taking her into, she was with another friend, Kathy was, and Shelly took her into the bathroom and made the other friend stay outside. The other friend said, I, you know, she was yelling at her or whatever. And Kathy emerged and she said, I'm going to go home now with Shelly, even though she had told her friend, I want out of there. I'm not happy there. I'm, you know, it's not a good situation. But she somehow, Shelly had this sway over these people and could lure them right back into her web.
All right. This story obviously comes to a crescendo, but, you know, before things blow up for Shelly, before her life becomes exposed, how many, there was, going back real quickly, and I'm sorry to keep bouncing, but it's like my mind is blown by the entire concept of this. If her kids are wearing the same clothes every day for a month, not bathing for weeks at a time, how are school officials and DCFS not getting involved in this?
Yeah, so it's early 90s when some of this was happening. And I think really, you know, look, Raymond isn't, that's the town. Raymond's not the richest town in Washington State, and it's rural. So probably there are a lot of kids that, maybe kids everywhere, go to school in the same clothes occasionally, or don't look clean. I get that happens. And the thing is, the times have changed. And I really do feel like if it were to happen today, you know that teachers are on the lookout now for this thing. They have to report it. They're a mandatory reporter. So maybe it wouldn't happen again the way it happened in this case. But I think that people just, you know, just accepted these were poor kids.
Okay. Now, you said that this crime continues on. Not only is she abusive to this friend, to her husband, to the children, how does the serial killer aspect begin in this? And maybe you can walk us to that point of how this breakdown continued and who was all involved in it.
Yeah, there were four victims of Shelly. First one was Kathy, and she grew very weak, and Shelly continued to torture her until Kathy died. And it's clearly a case of somebody causing that death, but we don't know really any of the facts about the body because they burned the body in the yard and destroyed that evidence. So there's Kathy, and
now,
then there is...
Are you aware of these murders, of these deaths that have taken place in their home?
Yes. In fact, when Kathy died... you know, but Shelly made a story up. They saw Kathy dead. They know they saw her, but they, you know, Kathy yanked, Shelly took them out of the house the night that Kathy died and said, you know, and took them to a motel so they could go swimming or something. Well, her husband burned the body. Her husband and her nephew Shane stayed behind to burn the body in the yard. And then, you know, the girls came back the next day and they could see the burn pile. And they, you know, it's like you could put two and two together, but you don't really want to. But it later became so apparent to them that Kathy was burned because their mom said, I need you to go out and look for bone fragments out in that burn pile. You know, and that's what the kids did. They, you know, they knew it was Kathy, and they knew it was, by then they were sure of what had happened. And they were, you know, it's like, and the mom would always say, you know, if anyone finds out, you know, our family will be destroyed. You'll go to foster care. I'll go to prison. We loved Kathy. This was a terrible accident, blah, blah, blah. So the girls went along with it, but it was only, you know, really to save themselves, because once, you know, once Kathy was gone, then the oldest girl, Nikki, became a target again. And they, all the kids, you know, were afraid of what would happen next. And of course it did happen again and again. And the second victim was the nephew, Shane. And Shane was 17, and he had been, he knew what was going on. In fact, he found some photographs of Kathy when she was made to do the housework naked. And she had photographs of Polaroids of Kathy doing the housework and laying on the floor. And he hid them in a teddy bear and said that he was going to take them to the police. And the next day he was gone. And the girls were told to go, you know, to go with friends for that day. They did not know that Shane had been murdered. They did not know for sure until, you know, many years later, but that was the second victim.
So she gets wind that he's going to go out and blow the whistle on this. So he's got to go as well. Do we know how she ended his life?
Well, yeah, she made her husband do it. She kept thinking, you know, Shane's going to tell, and we got to do something about it. So what about taking him into the woods and having a tree fall on him? And the husband said, well, that would be hard to do. He kept thinking, I'm stalling. I'm not ever going to do this. That Shelley is just, but Shelley kept pushing, said, you know what? He, you know, people are going to come look for him and we're going to get in trouble. You know, he's going to go to a bar, you know, and tell people or something like that. So finally, you know, Dave gives in to this relentless screaming pressure from his wife, and he shoots Shane and kills him that way. And then he goes and tells Shelley, you know, I did what you wanted. And she said, well, what is that? And he said, well, I killed Shane. And she said, you did what? You know, it was that's the kind of person she is.
Oh, good God. All right. So those are our first two victims, murder victims that we're aware of. Do you think, and we'll get into the next two, but looking through her life, do you think there's any possibility that there may have been others that we don't know about and may never uncover?
I don't think so. I mean, the police really looked into that. In fact, there was a missing child from her neighborhood, and she did try to, they tried to see whether they could link her to this boy, but they couldn't. I don't think she did. She was the kind of killer that killed people in her circle. She wasn't out killing anyone she didn't know.
All right. Which is even more bizarre. All right. So those are our two victims, first two victims. Who can you introduce us to next?
Next, she has a man named Ron Woodward come live with the family. And it's very much a repeat of the Kathy situation. Ron was down on his luck. He was, you know, his boyfriend of 12 years had dumped him. His mom and he were having, you know, a fight over the trailer that he owned, or that she owned, actually. And he ends up, you know, living with Shelley. And while they're living together, it's slow again. It's like taking away his stuff, you know, making him do the yard work in his underwear, telling him that he can't use the toilet in the house, that he has to go out in the yard. You know, he starts like, you know, kind of just like losing himself slowly, just like Kathy had done. It's exactly the same story. And at that time, he was also working with Shelley, helping with a man named Mac. And Mac was 80. He was in ill health. And Shelley and Ron would go over to help him in his house. And shortly after that started, Mac died. He had died from a fall in the house. And Shelley, you know, would come whenever she railed against Ron in the house in front of the kids, she would say things like, I can't believe we're living with a murderer. Ron killed Mac. You know, she would say that. It's like, it's ironic, of course, that she says, I can't believe we're living with a murderer, because she is one. But anyway, she played that game with Mac and Ron. And then later, of course, the very last victim was Ron. And Ron was just a shell of himself. I mean, she did horrible things to him, and he ended up dying. And when he died, that's really became the end of the story.
All right. His death happens. What is suddenly the fracture in this fable that starts to let the story out? I'm surprised she lasted this long doing the things she did and this kind of reign of evil. But what was the first fracture that happens?
It was her daughters. It was the two oldest. You know, had the oldest one had been kicked out of the house and been gone. She was like in her early 20s when this was happening. And the middle one was
kicked out of the house and was gone. That seems weird. You would think, knowing that this person has been abused and has been witness to all of this, she would have done her best to keep them close and not boot them out, not give them an opportunity to want to go forward and tell. So there was on top of the insanity, there was some pure up crazy in her thinking.
Well, get this, Dave. It wasn't, once she was gone, she wasn't really gone, in that the mom would find where she was and make the dad do stuff. Like, she worked at a Baskin Robbins, and the dad threw a brick through the window and blamed her for doing it. And, you know, she worked at a nursing home, and the mom would call and say that she was abusing patients there. She was doing everything, you know, Shelley and Dave were doing everything to get Nikki to come back home, you know, to destroy her, to make her come back. But she just wasn't going to have it. She's, you know, that was like the worst place in the world for her. You know, they couldn't let go of her. And I think after a while, they, you know, she did tell one time, but no one believed her. So they continued to get away with what they were doing.
So you said the oldest daughter who had left, and then the middle daughter, these are the two that end up deciding that needs to be told.
Yes. Those two, you know, after the youngest daughter, who's 14 at the time, says, I think Ron is dead. If he's not home when I get home, I think Mom killed him. And the other two older daughters did not know what was happening at home. What they thought, because Tori looked happy and was doing okay, they thought their mom had gotten better and that nothing bad was happening. Although, you know, the middle one, Sammy, did see some signs with Ron that he was deteriorating, and she probably wishes she paid more attention to that, but she didn't. So when the girls kind of compared notes, it was really Tori, the 14-year-old, that called her sisters and said, I can't live here another second. And then they went to the police the next day.
How does this, you know, they get together. How are they able to do that, go to the police without their mother knowing that this was taking place?
Right. The oldest one, who had made a complaint 2 years before, she went to the police again on her own. And so since Shelley and Dave didn't really have any contact with her anymore, they weren't missing her in terms of being, you know, not in the household or wondering what she was up to. But yeah, Nikki was the one who did it, because Tori, the youngest, said, you've got to stop her. And that's what happened.
So they go, she goes and makes this claim. How did the police initially react to this?
Well, they'd heard some of it before, because she had complained a couple years before Ron and Mac were killed. So, you know, they took statements, which I, you know, looked at from my book, that were very clear about that Kathy had been murdered and that their mom was abusing them and blah, 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 all of that. But the police didn't really investigate. They just sort of made a couple of trips out. You know, Shelley convinced them everything was fine and that, you know, that that Kathy had gone off to live in Hawaii with a truck driver boyfriend, and they kind of believed her story. They didn't believe a story from some of these girls that said, you know, Kathy was tortured. She was, you know, kept in the pump house for weeks on end, and she was fed rotten food. She, all these things that had been done to Kathy was just maybe too much for them to really believe.
It boggles the mind. Again, this isn't 1950s Mayberry.
Far from it.
They're aware crime takes place. How do the cops not take claims from somebody within the house seriously?
Right. Well, they know they have the last crime, Ron, that's on their watch. In fact, when I started writing the book, you know, I had a brief call with the detective that was in charge, and he indicated he would help me. And then there was never any time that would work. And then he stopped taking my calls. So I knew that he knew that I was getting the story from these girls, and he didn't want to be a part of it because there's really blood on their hands in Pacific County. They should have listened.
Well, what made them decide that this time was different? That this time they were going to pay attention to the, you know, cry of wolf?
Right. So this time they believed Tori and they believed Nikki, and they went out to the farm where all of it had happened, and it didn't take long for the dogs to alert where they had buried Ron. Ron didn't get burned up like the other ones. He was buried with the idea that they would burn his body later, and they weren't able to do it because it happened so fast.
When they start to find this and uncover, I mean, how quickly do things dissolve in this household, and how quickly are arrests made, and you kind of walk us through that?
Yep. I mean, like I said, it happened super fast because Dave confessed. Shelly never did. Dave confessed, and, you know, Shelly kept quiet, and, you know, he said, this is where the body is, and this is what we did to Kathy, and you know, here's what happened, you know, with all these different things that had happened. He was upfront about it, and he was full of remorse. He was glad it was over, where Shelly, you know, she was just going to, you know, try to blame him or do something. And so it happened so fast. It happened within a day that they'd found the body and they'd gotten the confession. And, you know, and the reason no one knows of this story is that there was never a trial. They both took the Alford plea, which means they agree they would be convicted based on the evidence, but they don't admit guilt.
Well, wait, now the Alford plea is what helped set free the West Memphis Three. How is the Alford plea in this case used and utilized so that they are still in prison for something that they're not claiming guilt to?
Right. Well, they've never challenged it. And maybe in the West Memphis case they did. But Dave has already served his 15 years. He's out of prison. He got out like a year and a half ago. And Shelley is due for parole in 2.5 years. So they've served their time or serving their time. Here's the thing. It's such an ugly story that if you put it in court, right, the world would know that you did the most despicable things to human beings that anybody could imagine. I mean, you and I have barely touched on what's in the book. So, you know, the stuff that she did was reprehensible. And she was able to just make that plea and cover her tracks.
All right. So making this plea, that she says, all right, listen, you have enough information to put us in jail. We don't need to go to trial. We'll just go and do our time. Mm-hmm. Isn't that kind of a cheat for the families? usually the Alford plea is kind of used more when they really don't have as firm a grasp on the case as they should. And they're saying, you know, hey, we've got enough that we could drag this out in court and it's going to get seen. You know, you're recognizing that you're aware of that, but you're not claiming guilt. Like I said, is usually kind of a waffly way for the law to get around, you know, and to do their job.
Yeah, I see where you're going with that. And here's the thing to remember. With Kathy and with Shane, there is no body at all because they were burned up. There's no way of knowing, you know, if they were sick or what was the true cause of death. So there's that. And then with Ron, when they dug Ron up, his health was bad.
Quickly, yeah, there was no proof of, you know, well, they were sick, they were this, they were that. But still, isn't there laws regarding how the body is treated after death? And
for sure. It's illegal to conceal a death. It's illegal to abandon a body. It's all of that. But in this particular case, we're dealing with a rural county in Washington State. I mean, as rural as it gets. And my feeling is that they were relieved. The prosecution was their only way to get out of this without maybe bankrupting them with an expensive trial was this Alford plea. It really would be the kind of thing where they can just wash their hands of it and be done with it. So I think there's some of that at play, too. If it were happening in a bigger city with more resources, I would expect that there would have been a trial. And but that's not going to happen down there. That didn't happen there anyway.
And what was the totality for the sentence that they each got?
Yeah, they got, I think, 18 years. Dave did. He served 15. And Shelley has 22 years. And she's going to serve it all before she's released.
That's...
That's why there's even a book in that these daughters believe that no one in the world knows what their mother's capable of and what she'll do again. They have no doubt that even though Shelley's 65, that she will find somebody weak to prey upon because that's how she got her kicks. That made her, the more she could hurt you, the happier she was. So there's, I mean, yeah, the sentences are light for what they did, and there was no consequence in terms of no public notoriety, no way to put them on the map as extreme abusers, and that's why these girls said, we want to write this book.
They want this story to be told because the court couldn't do it properly, and... they want the world to be aware of this. In your estimation, is this going to happen? Is she going to come out and is there going to be a bloody aftermath when she's released? And do you think it'll be fast or will we not find out again for another 10 years of what she's been up to?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to watch and see where she goes because I do think that she's a perfect example of a repeat offender.
How has she been in jail?
Listen to this, as sweet as pie. I have a friend that's a corrections officer that a young girl was getting out of the prison, the women's prison, and she was the correction officer was reading my book and said, do you know Shelley? And she said, yes, I was her roommate or I was her housemate in the prison. And she did what? And then, you know, the guard tells her some stuff. And then she said, I can't believe that because she's the nicest person in here.
Do you think that is part of the manipulation factor? Do you think she's gotten help while in prison that maybe her world has shifted and she realizes what she was doing isn't necessarily? No, it's just part of her long game.
It's a game. I mean, for sure. That, you know... there is no redemption for this woman. There's no way that she's going to get healed in prison through religion or through some sort of a program. It's in her DNA totally that she is a predator and she's just biding her time.
All right. Well, you know, we're, of course, the hopes are that when she gets out, there won't be a continuation of this abuse. Are the girls, and maybe you could walk us through that bit of the story, these girls coming forward, that had to be a hard part to share and tell, and know that then their lives are going to forever be scrutinized and under the microscope as well. How are they all adjusting?
You know, here's the thing about that. Sammy lives in Raymond. She's a school teacher. So everybody in town knows about Shelley. I mean, she's notorious within that small community. They don't know the details, but they know basically the Cliff's Notes version of what happened. And Nikki, the oldest, she's, you know, was the most removed from the story. She has no contact with her dad, Dave, and she has no contact, of course, with Shelley. As the other, none of the others do either, but the other two are in close contact with Dave. And, you know, Nikki was saying, look, nobody in my family, they know a little bit about my mom. My kids don't know that what my mom did, but they know she's in prison because she did something bad. And I, you know, I feel like of all of them, it's going to be life-changing for her to tell this story. But she said, I wanted to because I stand with my sisters and I believe that we need to do this. So I feel like, you know, she told me, she said, I don't think my kids who are, I think one of them was 12. I don't think my kids know really what my mom did. And I thought to myself, you know what, if my mom told me my grandma was in prison, I'd get on the internet and Google her name. Wouldn't you? So I think they probably know, but she also told me, she said, you know, Greg, I told you things that I've never told my husband. I just didn't go that far with him about what happened. So I think that's going to be, you know, this Thanksgiving will be different for them more than the other two because, you know, she was removed from the story for the longest and now it's all come back.
How did they avoid falling into the same trappings of their mother who was raised around an abusive, psychotic person?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that. All I can tell you is they did. They found people in their lives that are good. And two of them have children of their own. The youngest one doesn't have any kids yet, but they somehow found themselves out of all of this craziness and were able to say, you know, what my mom did to me and what my dad did is not going to define me, or I'm not going to be that person. And I want you to know, they really are great. You know, sure, they have baggage from their past. But if you looked at them today, you would be proud, Dave, to be, you know, a friend with any one of them or visit with them. They are lovely.
See, that tells you something, right? I mean, like you said, it was part of Shelley's DNA. You don't think she'd ever change from that. But yet these girls who were subjected to the same kind of life that Shelley was in witnessing these things taking place, they went the other way. So, you know, it definitely shows people don't have to be a victim of their circumstance, of their upbringing. Because they had this or that happen does not mean that, you know, that they need to do the same thing or to keep the cycle of hatred and anger going forward. We all are very capable. And boy, these three girls are living proof and examples that we don't have to live in that shadow and do what is expected because, you know, it's what's expected. We should be able to move past it and live, learn, and change.
Right. I mean, totally agree with you on that. And I think they are really the great examples of that. You know, Sammy told me, she said, you know, sometimes when I talk to people about what happened to me, they would always say, well, I would have gotten out of there. You know, I would have left right away. And her answer is always, well, that's you living my life. And I thought that was really a great way to put it. It's like we can judge from our lens what we think we would do, but we really can't understand what another person would do based on their circumstances. So, you know, I look at them as examples of something others should aspire to. You know, yeah, you can say you had a lousy childhood or whatever, or you, you know, your brothers beat you up or whatever. It's like, okay, you can choose to make that be the center of your life, or you can choose to shove it aside and concentrate on some things that are more beautiful, which is what they have all done.
It's a remarkable line too. That's you living my life. It's very easy to say from the outside how any of us would react to a situation. Right. We have the foresight of, or I should say the 2020 hindsight of knowing what they went through and standing in righteous indignation of, oh, well, I would never fall prey or victim to that. And I can't tell you how many girls I knew that I grew up with that would swear they would never stay in abusive relationships, and how many of them I know are still taking beatings to this day. Mm. And you like to think that you have a handle and control and that you would never do these things until you're put in that position. And suddenly there's this balance of, I need to be here to protect my children. I need to be here to protect my life. I have nothing without this. Even this abuse is better than being cast out and living in a homeless shelter or being on my own. And logic and heart tell us two different things. Logic tells us, get the hell out. The heart says, we need to get through this. We need to find a way. You know, I want to, maybe I can help this person. Maybe they'll change for me. And you can't make just this blanket decision of, well, she was stupid. Look at what she went through. No, that's not the way life works.
Right. That's exactly right.
And as you said, and it was a slow breakdown for a lot of these people.
It was a slow breakdown, and you give into it. But think about it. If you're out in the middle of nowhere, and you have nowhere to go, okay? You have nobody. You have no more friends. Your family hates you, or you think they do. And you've got this woman who will alternately build you up. Oh, you look great today. Or take you down. You need to go, you know, into the pump house for 2 days for your abuse or for your problem. You know, so there's that. There was like, if you have nobody and somebody alternately gives you a little hope, a little bit of love, but really, you know, the hammer is the evil part, but you still hope for the good the next day.
Yeah, you certainly do. There's just always that hope of payout. It's the same kind of mentality for gamblers, right? Maybe just $5 more. Maybe that's going to be what sets me off and puts me back on the right path. Just one more day. And boy, folks, if you are in a position like this, there is places to get help. There are places to reach out to. And you don't need to remain a victim of these kind of crimes to yourself or others in your family. Stand up. It may be the hardest thing you do, but the people that you love deserve to be set free from the terror of whoever is abusing you, and do it. You know, the frightening thing is how many people do get turned away. You know, they go to the police, and the police will go interview the husband, and everything seems fine. Well, he was very pleasant and kind and quiet and reserved. I don't think that, you know, maybe just kind of avoid each other for a day or two, and they don't take into account. And I'm not beating up the police. It's got to be a hard job. You've got to try to gauge personalities. You've got to try to be judge, jury, and executioner, you know, in all of these cases of understanding what it is you're up against, because you have another call coming in 5 minutes anyway. It's got to be a tough job for the police to have to deal with all of these type of domestic situations. And I'm sure that the veil has been pulled over their eyes many times, and it's not because they're bad police officers. It's just because there's so much that they see, so much that they have to do, so many places that their minds are stretched to, that it's got to be pretty damn hard to be, you know, 100% effective, as we see all of, you know, cop shows on TV make every one of these cops the biggest genius you've ever run into, and their focus is laser point. But you don't realize that that's not the real world. Our world has been shaped, unfortunately, by entertainment as opposed to the reality of what's going on out there.
That's right. And I truly don't blame the police as much as some might, in that Shelley was a very good mimic, as sociopaths are. And she could mimic that she was concerned or that she was indignant or any of those things that a law enforcement officer might see to engage in terms of, like, what's this person like? And so she has a talent for that. And a lot of them did.
Folks, go check darknessradio.com. Click on the shop button or store button there, and it'll take you into our Amazon storefront. We have our books separated for the paranormal shows we do, the true crime shows we do. Get the book, If You Tell, A True Story of Murder, Family Secrets, and the Unbreakable Bond of Sisterhood. Get the book. Educate yourself. Like Greg said, we've told a very twisted, sad, terrifying tale today, but have not even scratched the surface of just how bizarre this story really is. So please pick up the book. And remember, when you do pick up the book, rate and review it on Amazon so that people can find this book and more people can become aware of it. The fascination in true crime is higher than it's ever been. And so many of these authors writing great books are getting lost by you taking just a few seconds to rate and review these books. It helps keep their work relevant, keeps it out in the public, and exposes it to more. And with a woman like this coming out of prison in just a few years, more people should know that there are predators like this walking our streets and where exactly they are. Greg, the girls, what are their plans? Do you see them ever communicating with their mother in the future, ever?
Never. They're done. Sammy was the one that did do a little bit of communication in the beginning of the incarceration, but she stopped. But the other ones, never, and they never will.
This woman is so corrupt. Do you think that they're safe? Even if they never go out of their way to see their mother, do you think that they're safe in the long run, or are they going to constantly be looking over their shoulders until the day their mother's in the ground?
Yeah, that's a really great question. They've never expressed that. I mean, they are way stronger than their mother is. They are going to be victims no more, for sure. So if Shelley would come after them, I think the girls would know what to do.
I hope so. From your lips to God's ears, may these girls finally know peace. And if and when this woman gets released, we just pray that her heart has changed and there will be no more victims. Although it's a cynical world, and it's the reality of it is most likely she's going to do something stupid and heinous again. We can only hope and pray that that won't occur, and that these girls finally get their peace away from their mother and don't have to live in a state of fear. Greg, thank you so much for coming on today to share the story with us.
Hey, Dave, thanks a lot. And thanks to Tim too. Really appreciate it.
It's been an eye-opening experience. If You Tell, A True Story of Murder, Family Secrets, and the Unbreakable Bond of Sisterhood. That's the book, out and available December 1st, 2019. Make sure you get a copy of the book. And again, we have a link to it by going to darknessradio.com. It's also right on today's program. So you see all the information about the show at the bottom of that will be a link to the book. You can go order it and pre-order it right now. All right, Tim. It's time to examine the case files, and we've got a twisted tale of murder and many other stupid accounts to deal with this week in dumb crimes and stupid criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim. Now, I talked straight out of the chute about having a very strange story. And since we're coming out of a serial killer's life and somebody doing something you just can't really wrap your head around, here's an interesting, weird story. Dumb crimes, it certainly fits into that. A stupid criminal, no doubt, but what a bizarre crime to have taken place. We're going to Coral Springs, Florida. Police say a Florida woman claimed not to know the victim of a fatal shooting who was found dead in her driveway. But they determined that the two actually were gym friends and now believe that the woman shot the 21-year-old after receiving a ride home. Yvonne Serrano, age 51, is charged with second-degree murder and tampering with physical evidence in relation to the fatal shooting of 21-year-old Daniela Taberas. Now, police responded to Serrano's home Saturday morning after the suspect called 911 to say there was a dead woman in her driveway. Investigators believe the victim, identified as Tabaris, lay dead with a gunshot wound to her forehead for hours.
No.
The driver's side door was open. The victim's foot was still inside the vehicle, the arrest report said. Serrano told detectives she didn't know the 21-year-old. However, upon investigation, officers discovered the two were friends who often worked out together and went to the movies and other gym members with other gym members on Friday night. They had gone to a gym function at the World of Beer Bar and Kitchen in Coconut Creek, Florida. I need a gym, Tim, that ends with me at a beer bar.
Oh, absolutely. Everyone does. Yeah.
I'd be willing to go to the gym, I would say, more often, but just go to the gym is more often than what I've been doing. Following the night of drinking, Tabaris gave Serrano a ride home. Surveillance video shows the woman laughing and talking before leaving the bar. Police say Serrano, who has a concealed weapon permit and brought her gun with her to the event, shot and killed Tabaris. The motive still remains a mystery. Serrano claims she doesn't remember any of it. Police say she changed her story multiple times. At some point in the driveway, the suspect did shoot our victim and then called police a little later while advising she didn't know who she was, said Coral Springs Police Sergeant Carla Kometic. So you hang out with this person.
Mm-hmm.
You hang out with this person with other people.
Mm-hmm.
You hang out with this person with other people in places where you're being videotaped. And really your thought is, I can get through this. I'll just tell them I don't know who she is. Police say Serrano deleted video of the crime from her Ring camera. She is also accused of washing her shirt from the night before by the time officers responded. These alleged actions led to tampering with evidence change. Tabaris' friends and family are grieving her loss and struggling to make sense of what happened. Daniela was literally the sweetest person you could possibly imagine, and it wouldn't be uncommon for her to do exactly what she did, which is to give this woman a ride home from where she was, said George Davies, who is friends with both women. To hear her describe what was going on so matter-of-factly and to act like she had no idea what transpired, it's very strange. Serrano is being held at the Broward County Jail without bond. Police are continuing to investigate to determine a motive. I don't know. People are so bizarre, man. You kind of got to be at the time and place in your life now where who do you trust?
It's very hard, yeah, to answer that question. And what motive could you possibly have to shoot someone who's helping you out, you know?
In the head. Well, unfortunately, we've heard that before. Look at Good Samaritans that have pulled over to – and remember, there was a story about this, I think, when – I want to say it was the early 90s. It was during that big snowstorm in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
People had pulled over to help somebody who was stranded by the side of the road with a flat tire. They changed the tire for the person. Then the person beat them to death with the tire iron.
Yeah, yeah.
Killed the person that helped them. What are you thinking? What? I can't rationalize it. And every day you hear more of these stories where people are just killing to kill.
Yeah.
I don't think you even need a reason. We want to put and understanding on each one of these stories. And the sad thing is, I think we're getting to the place where there is not any longer. The world is fractured, man. People are crazy.
Unfortunately, ugh. Yeah. And there's, you're right. You can't put an understanding behind some things, and you can't put an understanding behind that story. That's for sure.
Well, at least we still have a place to go, Tim, where everything is safe. Everybody is happy. It is the happiest place on earth. Disney World. You never hear any strange crimes. Oh, never mind, Tim. Authorities say a 51-year-old Florida man groped a Walt Disney World worker dressed as a princess during a photo opportunity at the Magic Kingdom. An Orange County Sheriff's Office affidavit says Brian Sherman and his wife posed for pictures with the woman on Saturday afternoon. Sherman said the character was his favorite before putting his arm around her and groping her breast.
Wow.
The affidavit says Sherman sat on one side of the woman and his wife on the other side. Co-workers told investigators the victim wasn't able to move before Sherman groped her. She was crying when Sherman left the room. The Disney photographer provided the pictures to investigators who used them to identify Sherman, who was then booked on battery charges. A lawyer wasn't listed on court records. dude, you're not even safe as a Disney princess.
No, no. And I mean, it's not even the real cartoon character that you're groping. So, you know, I mean, it's
wait, so in your book, it'd be okay to grope a cartoon character's boob, but not a human?
Well, cartoon characters don't have feelings, Dave.
Wow.
No, really? I'm kidding.
Really? Tell that to Bugs Bunny. I saw him tear up many times.
Did he? Did he really, Dave?
Yeah.
I mean, was it because, you know, you used the carrot? No, I'm kidding. No.
Florida man. I'm going to move on, Tim. Okay. Florida man with a don't drink and drive bumper sticker was arrested for, drinking and driving, Tim. Hard to believe. Whoops. Largo police arrested 56-year-old Sergio Ferreira on a charge of driving under the influence on Friday night. The man's car had a don't drink and drive bumper sticker, according to an arrest report filed by the police department. At about 8:15 p.m., Ferreira of Largo rear-ended the car in front of him near Ulmerton and Starkey Roads, the report said. At the time of the accident, Ferreira was driving a red Ford pickup about 35 to 40 miles per hour, fast enough to cause the car he hit to then hit the car in front of it. No one was injured, thankfully, at least not seriously enough to warrant a trip to the hospital. Responding officers noted that Ferreira had difficulty standing up straight with bloodshot eyes. They also smelled alcohol pouring off his breath, according to the report. Ferreira told officers he had consumed 4 20-ounce cans of Busch Light before he got behind the wheel.
Oh, egg. Busch
Light?
Yeah, right?
You're going to go down for Busch Light?
Ugh.
Hard to believe, but he refused to give officers a breath sample.
No.
Officers arrested Ferreira and booked him into the Pinellas County Jail. He faces a misdemeanor charge of DUI involving property damage, court records show. That's weird to me. He was released on a $500 bond. Tim, he had a high blood alcohol content, drank 4 20-ounce cans of Busch Light, which is a crime in itself.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Used to give officers a breath sample, hit one car so hard it sent it careening into another car, and this is a misdemeanor?
Unfortunately, Dave, yes.
Why do we have to wait until somebody's dead? Why isn't somebody like this Dave, everybody makes one mistake. You've driven drunk. Sure, it was a dumbass thing to do, and I deserve to go to jail. I should have gone to jail. Thankfully, I didn't hit anything or anybody. But when you hit a car, whether somebody died or not, if you're drunk, man, I really think they need to throw the book at you. I just do, and I'm sure I just pissed off a handful of our listeners.
Oh, I think if you're doing any damage, you should be in jail. Yeah.
It should not be a misdemeanor. And in a $500 bond, big deal.
Yeah, you don't learn any lessons that way.
Now, he had no prior convictions, the arrest report noted. That still just doesn't do it for me. You know, just because you made one mistake. Oh, well, you know what? I shot Tim to death repeatedly, but I had no criminal record. So, come on. You can't be mad at me. It was a one-off. Put me in jail. Let me out on $500 bond. Come on. That makes sense to me. Maybe not. I don't know.
First time's a mistake. Second time, you really meant it?
Yeah, right.
I don't know.
That should be it. Since we're talking to DUIs, according to the arrest report obtained by TMZ, Sam Hunt, the country music singer.
Ah, yes. I heard about this one. Yeah.
Crossed the central divider several times in his vehicle while he was searching for his ID. Cops say it was very openly sitting on his lap, the ID, that is.
Whoops.
Hunt took a field sobriety test and allegedly showed numerous signs of impairment on all tests conducted. Country star Sam Hunt was arrested Thursday morning for drunk driving. Hunt was allegedly driving the wrong way down a Nashville street when cops spotted him and pulled him over. Witnesses say he had been swerving as well. According to police, Hunt smelled of booze and his eyes were bloodshot. Police say there were 2 empty beer cans next to him. Police say Hunt, whose hits include Drinking Too Much, had trouble pulling out his driver's license and instead handed a cop a credit card and a passport. They also say he admitted to recently drinking. Cops did a field sobriety test and found his blood alcohol level was a 0.173. twice the legal, more than twice the legal limit. Hunt was released Thursday morning after posting $2,500 bond. He's scheduled to appear in court on January 17th.
See, the passport, Dave, is to prove who you are. The credit card is just to charge your own bribe. You just give yourself as much as you need to get me off of this charge.
I think anybody with a hit song called Drinking Too Much should have been followed from the start all the time anyway.
Yeah, maybe.
He's kind of telegraphing his issues.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
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 Boy, I don't know where to go with this. I do have a story I can't wait to share with you. Well, since we're talking bad driving and using the wrong ID, let's go to Wisconsin for our next story, Tim.
Oh, good.
Where a suspected drunk driver had fake Wisconsin plates made from Ham's beer boxes, police say. We're going to Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, where a suspected drunk driver in Wisconsin tried to pull one over on police with fake license plates made from a box of Ham's beer. According to the Chippewa Falls Police Department, an officer recently pulled over a driver for suspected drunk driving when he noticed the registration plates on the vehicle did not match the vehicle. A closer look revealed that the plates were not real. They were made of cardboard, and while the front resembled a Wisconsin license plate, when the officer flipped them over, the Ham's beer logo was clearly visible. I thought that was just Wisconsin's way of recycling.
It could be, yeah, but yeah. It doesn't shock me, no.
It's crazy, dude. I'm looking at the plates that he's holding up,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
They look like real license plates. I mean, it's unbelievable how good these fakes look, made of cardboard. In a Facebook post, the police department wrote of the handmade license plates, maybe they are legal in the land of sky blue waters, but just not here in Chippewa Falls, referencing Ham's memorable slogan. Ham's was first brewed in St. Paul, Minnesota.
Yes.
Oh, so yeah. Wisconsin, again, trying to take a shot at Minnesota.
Yeah, well, but see, they're probably superior plates, I'm sure. That's why they look so good. But again, it didn't pass the test. Yeah.
As long as we're talking about bad fakery, Tim, and costuming,
mm-hmm,
if
mm-hmm.
you would.
Yeah.
We're going to go to a British robbery suspect.
Okay.
Who tried to pull a Clark Kent, Tim.
Huh.
I'm going to give you this. I'm going to give you this link as we talk, because I want you to see this character for yourself and what an ingenious disguise he used, Tim, to try to hold up a place. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Y'all ready for this?
Y'all is ready for this.
All right, hold on a second. I got to send you this link, Tim, because
sure,
you got to take a look. I mean, it's uncanny.
You're not sending it by Pony Express or U.S. Mail.
I am. Yeah, it seems I am. All right. Yeah, okay. A robbery suspect in England thought he could evade authorities with a new look. He put on a pair of glasses. David Springthorpe, 30, was wanted for allegedly shoplifting and violating a court order when he recently came into contact with a police officer in South Normanton. A short chase ensued, and he was detained, authorities said. Springthorpe, a white man with blue eyes, brown hair, wide ears, and a notable neck tattoo, tried to disguise himself by wearing a pair of Darkness Radio Dave's black-rimmed glasses, Tim. Says so right here in the article. That, the Alfreton police wrote on a Facebook Tuesday, was not quite cunning enough to outsmart the team. Especially because when you look at him, he has one janky ear that sticks like completely out sideways from his head. He looks like Alfred E. Newman.
It looks like he's trying to
smile,
trying to catch a breeze, like a big sail off the side of his head.
Right. So, yeah. Boy, you know, yeah, the hair hasn't changed.
Mm-hmm.
The neck tattoo's the same. One conky ear, but you threw on a pair of glasses. Hey, I don't know who you're talking about. I love Superman as much as you love Superman. Right. He's trying to pull the old Clark Kent, Tim.
Yeah.
A pair of glasses are not going to disguise that ear, one commentator ridiculed about Springthorpe's look change. You would think you would have kept an ear out, another user wrote.
Oh, no.
Springthorpe was convicted of theft for stealing perfume gift sets. Oh, he's going to be popular in jail for 30 weeks, Tim.
Yeah, he is.
He's going to smell pretty, and he likes to wear costumes.
Mm.
Huh?
Yeah, he's going to be popular, yeah.
Let's see. As well, you know, talking about holding places up, let's check. Let me see here real quick. I'm just trying to look at a couple of these crazy stories that we've got here. Hold on one second. Let's do this real quickly. Undoubtedly the most fitting funny shit content we've talked about this year, Tim. A group of low-life thieves try to siphon fuel. I've discovered there's more than one holding tank on a tour bus, Tim.
Oh, no, no, no. Really?
The unknown individual spotted the bus parked in Laverton, Central West Australia, in the middle of the night. But when they tried to pinch some free fuel, they mistakenly put the hose in the sewage tank, copping a mouthful of raw sewage in the process. Police discovered the failed attempt when the sewage tank cap was found on the ground the next morning. We can infer they beat a very hasty retreat with a somewhat bitter taste in their mouth, Laverton Police Senator Sergeant Heath Sauter told Yahoo. Unsurprisingly, police have zero interest in recovering the stolen goods. But they are keen on a laugh, adding that we hope word of mouth would lead them to the criminals. If you know someone who has shit breath, do get in touch, it says, according to the Australian police. Speaking of poo and idiots, it reminds us of the time. Oh, this is just going into a different article.
Brings new meaning to the phrase potty mouth.
Now this woman is amazing, Tim. I'm going to send you her image as well.
Okay.
And she might be single, so I'm just saying you might want to keep it close.
I don't know that I want to, but
you know, a man broke into a Rochester, New York home of 82-year-old grandmother. And well, Tim, it just didn't end well for him. Have you seen the picture of Granny yet?
I have.
Yeah. She's a bodybuilding 82-year-old grandmother. Well, Willie Murphy said she was getting ready for bed Thursday when a man began pounding on her door, urging her to call an ambulance for him. CNN affiliate Wham reported. That's WHAM, the Wham, Tim. Murphy told Wham she called the police but wouldn't let the man in her house. Then she said he became angry and broke through the door. It's kind of semi-dark and I'm alone and I'm old, but guess what? I'm tough, she said, baring her muscular arms. He picked the wrong house to break into. Murphy is an award-winning bodybuilder. 82-year-old award-winning bodybuilder who said she works out at her local YMCA every day. As Murphy tells it, she used a barrage of household items to attack the intruder, beginning with her own table. I took that table and I went to working on him, she said. And guess what? The table broke.
Oh.
Unfazed, Murphy said she used the metal legs of the table to keep hitting him. After jumping on him a couple times, Murphy ran into the kitchen, grabbed a bottle of baby shampoo, and squirted it on the man's face as he tried to get up.
Well, that's foreplay right there.
Well, yeah. Unfortunately, there's, you know, the baby shampoo's non-tearing.
Yeah.
So it didn't end there. Next, she took a broom and whacked him with it some more. By that time, the intruder was ready to leave, though Murphy said she can deadlift 225 pounds.
Good God.
She struggled to drag the man out of the house. He wants to get the heck out of there, and I'm trying to help him get the hell out of the house, but he's too heavy. I can't move him. He was just dead weight. At that point, the police arrived in response to Murphy's earlier call. So they come in, she said. He's laying down already because I'd already done a number on him. I'm serious. The man was put into an ambulance. Murphy thinks he was probably relieved to be out of that house. I think he was very happy when he went into that ambulance because I sent him in the ambulance. Yes, I did.
Willie Murphy! Bah!
Chicken ass! Taking names! Boom!
I'm just thinking of the Dave Chappelle skit. She's wearing a powerlifting shirt in this picture, and she's flexing her muscles. If I walked in, if I'm a burglar and I walk in, I just walk right back out. I'm just like, sorry, wrong house.
Sorry to bother you. Let me get out of here.
Let me leave.
Tim, sometimes you don't have to be a dirty criminal when you're holding the place up. We have proof of that as we go to Sarasota County. Deputies arrested two people in connection with an armed robbery that happened Monday morning. Well, what's so different about this robbery, you say? Well, let's go to Osprey, Florida. Sarasota County deputies arrested two people in connection with an armed robbery that happened Monday morning. Trenton Richardson and Shane Redman arrested after an investigation, according to deputies. Richardson was wearing an exfoliating mask when he was arrested, Tim.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh. Well, you know, if you're going to get caught, you're going to get put in jail, yeah, you want to look good for the boys.
Sure.
Deputies responded to a retail store in the 13,000 block of S. Tamiami Trail in Osbury for reports of an armed robbery. The victim witnessed a man leaving the store through an emergency exit with a cart full of merchandise. When confronted, the man held the victim at gunpoint and loaded the stolen merchandise into a car behind the business. A woman was driving the car, according to deputies. The victim was uninjured. Both man and the woman drove away. Deputies said fingerprints recovered at the scene led detectives to Richardson, and an investigation led to Redman as the driver. Both were taken into custody. The stolen merchandise was recovered, and Richardson's face is still not flawless, even after using some exfoliating facial cream, Tim.
That's too bad. I mean, you know, good beauty is essential wherever you are.
Yeah, he's in jail on a $100,000 bond.
Well, he could use some good beauty then.
Sometimes it's better to look good than to feel good. He looks good, Tim. He's gonna be well loved. Yeah. Now, here's a weird story from Florida.
Okay.
Let me just read the headline to you and just let it simmer for a few seconds, Tim.
Sure.
Florida man arrested after repeatedly pushing a 12-year-old girl to the ground during soccer practice. Before hugging and tickling her.
What?
A 40-year-old Florida man was arrested this week after being accused of repeatedly pushing a child to the ground during a soccer game. Donald Edward Mullins of Tarpon Springs was detained by deputies from the Pasco County Sheriff's Office Tuesday morning and charged with simple battery. The incident took place in Newport Richey at approximately 7:20 on November 4th. According to police, the victim, a 12-year-old girl, said Mullins had pushed her to the ground between 3 and 4 times against her will. The suspect is a coach for a separate soccer team, but had joined a scheduled practice game being held for the juvenile's victim's team at the time of the incident. The child said the pushing occurred during the match, with police noting that such contact is not considered to be part of normal gameplay. Oh, he was just flirting, Tim. You know, knock the girl down you like and then tickle her. Oh, that's right. He's an adult man and she's a child. Weird.
Creepy.
The victim, who was not named in the report, noted that her encounter with the soccer coach did not end there, alleging that it continued after the match. The sheriff's office stated the victim said after practice, the defendant approached her and hugged her from behind while she sat on a bench. It added the victim said the defendant forced her hands above her head and began to tickle her against her will, even after she tried to pull away from him and told him to stop. Police said the man was captured on video surveillance hugging and tickling the girl. That's all. Huggy tickle. I would mace the shit out of this guy for touching my daughters. Mullins later told investigators he believed the victim to be a family friend and conceded that his actions had been unacceptable. He was arrested and transported to county jail. Post-Miranda, with his attorney present, the defendant admitted to playing a practice game with the victim and having incidental contact, the arrest report stated, adding that Mullins admitted to hugging the victim and grabbing her arms prior to tickling her. The arrest was confirmed using inmate records posted online, which said he was booked into the facility at about 2 p.m. on Tuesday. He was released an hour and a half later after posting how much bond, Tim? Knocking a girl to the ground repeatedly, then sneaking up on her, hugging her from behind, lifting her arms over her head, and tickling her.
Well, it's Pasco County, so I'm going to say they see this stuff all the time, and I'm going to say it's probably $500.
$500. Ding, 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 ding. You are correct, Tim. In Florida, simple battery is a first-degree misdemeanor, which carries penalties of up to 1 year in jail, 12 months probation, and a $1,000 fine, says the law firm of Hassan and Weber. To commit the crime of misdemeanor battery, an accused person does not have to injure the alleged victim. The intentional touching against another person will is sufficient.
If this happened at a soccer match, Dave, then I think that girl should have kicked that guy's balls all the way into the goal.
There's that.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm going to leave this story out because although it's a funny story, Tim, one of the players in it is wearing a recognizable political hat and shirt. And if I read it and call it dumb crime, stupid criminals, half the audience is going to think I'm making a political statement. The other half is going to think that I'm not, and that it's great, and I should read more stories like this. But so I just rereading it, I'm just going to pass on the story. I'll just give you the headline. How about that?
Okay.
Florida man wearing a MAGA shirt robs a bank, handing a hope to get caught note to the teller. She overpaid him too. He asked for $1,100. She gave him like $1,500, and he gave her money back and said, "You overpaid me."
That was nice of him.
Yeah. Well, he probably knows, you know, anything under $1,100 is probably like a misdemeanor crime.
Yes, that's probably what it is.
I'm betting.
Yeah.
All right, Tim, this one's a little gag inducing.
Okay.
A Florida man is accused of spitting food into the woman's mouth following a road rage incident.
Ew.
Baby birded this bitch right then and there on the spot, Tim. Pinellas County Sheriff's deputies arrested 61-year-old David Paul Whipperman Thursday on felony charges for the incident that took place on October 29th. An arrest report says that Whipperman got into a road rage incident with a woman that evening. He got out of his truck, approached the woman's vehicle. She rolled down her window and apologized to Whipperman. The report says Whipperman then spit the food he was chewing at her into her open mouth. I wonder if it was an accident. Did he just spit the food at her? And she was like, "I'm so sorry." And she, as she says, "Sorry," it's just like, in goes the half a sandwich. Yeah. Yeah. So that's it. That's the entirety of that story. He was arrested. All right, Tim.
As he should be.
I got to tell you, we live in a weird world. Every week we prove that with these stories.
Mm-hmm.
But, Tim, I've come to the point in life where I just don't even know who to trust anymore, where to turn, and what to believe. And you say, Dave, how could that be? Well, the Sacramento Bee is reporting this article, Tim. The Sacramento Bee.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
I didn't realize that things in the world of Oscar Mayer and baloney were getting bad out there, Tim, but they are.
I believe it. Yeah.
Because more than 150 pounds of black market baloney has been seized in Texas. That's what border agents are saying.
What?
I've heard of drugs, Tim, electronics, cell phones.
Yeah.
You know, black market kidneys, livers, eyes, body parts, right?
Yeah.
Children, trafficking children. I've heard of that, Tim.
Sure.
A bunch of baloney? Well, that statement took on a different meaning after U.S. Customs and Border Protection agricultural specialists confiscated 14 rolls of Mexican bologna on Thursday morning. As a border agent, are you trained to look for rolls of bologna in the backseat of a car?
No, I don't think you are.
Bologna was seized because it is a prohibited product made of pork and has the potential for introducing foreign animal diseases to the U.S. pork industry. Officials noticed a man driving a Chevrolet truck with a Texas license plate enter from the Port of Mexico just after 9 a.m. An officer spotted red rolls behind the backseat of the truck and asked, "What are you bringing from Mexico?" And he responded, "Frozen rolls of turkey ham." Officials confiscated the 14 rolls weighing more than 154 pounds. And destroyed it and released the driver. It's important that travelers understand they should declare all items that they're transporting from abroad to avoid fines and penalties. A properly declared prohibited item can be abandoned at the port without consequence. Tim,
yeah.
What type of terrorism are they looking for with rolls of bologna?
Gastrointestinal.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
And how bad, listen, I'm not going to lie, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
One of my holdovers from childhood is I enjoy a good bologna sandwich.
Oh, yeah.
Sounds like an oxymoron, good bologna sandwiches. Two things you don't think you'd hear in one sentence. But I love me a good bologna sandwich, and I've gone years without it. I've never once thought, you know what, if I can't find some Oscar Mayer, B-O-L-O-G-N-A, Tim, I got to go over to Mexico and get me some of that black market bologna.
Dave,
black market baloney.
Dave, you know
that's the world.
You know what'll change your life?
What?
Boar's head baloney.
Boar's head baloney.
Yeah.
It sounds disgusting. See, I wouldn't like cheesecake. pumpkin pie are two things I won't eat because the names of them make me sick.
It's
boar's head bologna makes it sound like you've ordered out of a boar's brain.
No. It's the brand name boar's head.
I know, but it just sounds gross.
It sounds gross, but it is a little slice of heaven in the bologna world.
Really? So there's an artesian bologna, Tim?
That's exactly it. It's artesian bologna.
Interesting. I'll give it a try. I don't know, man. I'm an Oscar Mayer guy. I'm not going to lie to you. My bologna has a first name, Tim. It's OSCAR. My bologna, it has a second name, and that's MAYER.
Dave, I'm telling you, when I'm craving bologna, when I'm craving a bologna sandwich, I will go. Uh-huh. I don't even look Oscar Mayer's way anymore. And I'm sorry, Oscar Mayer. I'm sorry. I apologize from the bottom of my heart. But what I do.
How dare you, Tim? Oscar Mayer has a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A.
I know
it's
this.
It's in the damn song, Tim.
I know this, Dave. And I even shed a small tear when I see the Wienermobile drive by my house. But here's what I do, Dave, is I go to let's just say, a little bit of a boutique grocery store in the area, and I know the name, I won't say it on the air here, and I will go to the deli section.
A rich man's life. Sheesh.
Well, it's not that much more expensive than your other Oscar Mayer bologna. It's in fact it's only a few pennies more.
A few pennies, you say?
Yeah. You get yourself some boar's head bologna. You just don't even share it with the kids. It's that good. I'm telling you. It's that good. Boar's head bologna.
Very. All right. You've sold me on it, guys, gals. Don't go to the black market. Go to the boar's head for
That's
the best
right.
bologna, apparently, according to Tim Dennis.
That's right.
It for this week, kids. We're done. True crimes are over. Remember, get the book. You can find the link right on today's program. Click that link. Go order the book. And rate and review the books for our authors. It does help them a lot. We appreciate it. And hey, we want to hear from you guys. Put some more comments on each one of these episodes. What did you like about them? What would you like to hear? Are there other kind of crimes you'd like us to cover? Do you want more dumb crimes, less stupid criminals, more stupid criminals, less dumb crimes? We want to hear from you. So start commenting on every episode. Chime in. Let us know you're out there breathing. We see thousands of you subscribing. We want to hear from you. So make sure you go on the app and say a little hi to us, would you? Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Take care. Have a loving, happy week filled with lots of love and laughter. And please avoid the black market bologna, at least until after the new year. For that guy, I'm this guy. You've been listening to that show. This is True Crime Tuesday.